Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Speaking today with Virginia Pustrell. Ms. Pustrell is former editor-in-chief of Reason Magazine. She's the author of The Future and Its Enemies, The Growing Conflict Over Creativity, Enterprise, and Progress. She also writes a fascinating web blog at www.dynamist.com and has many of her writings and interviews there. Welcome, Virginia.
Thanks.
Now, the book and much of your recent writing has been about this idea of stasism versus dynamism. And I wonder if you could give us what your standard answer is to the definition of those two.
I wish it were so easy. Well, first of all, I'm trying to make the point that on a lot of the sort of cutting edge issues today, our traditional categories of left and right, while not meaningless, are not helpful. They don't really predict who's going to line up on what side because both the traditional left and the traditional right are kind of divided on issues such as biotechnology that we'll talk about more specifically. And so what I'm proposing is an alternative to think about a division between people who are in favor of stability and control, stasis, as the sort of primary social values, if you will, that the good society is under control, it's orderly, it's predictable, and it doesn't change very much, versus people who are in support of what I call dynamism, which is a freer, less predictable system where sort of change bubbles up from the bottom, if you will. And their primary social value, if you is learning, which is not just the sort of accumulation of scientific knowledge, although that's an aspect of it, the scientific process being a classic dynamic process, but also just learning how better to do things, how to improve products, how to, you know, better raise children, whatever it might be. And the insight is that doesn't come through a deductive process. It comes through incremental improvements and experimentation and feedback.
Now, you said that this isn't a right-left dynamic, although a lot of your book seems to be a critique of traditional liberal ideas or statist ideas. You make a distinction between reactionary statists and technocrats. Are reactionary statists conservative stasists and technocrats left-wing stasists?
No, I would actually divide it a little bit differently. What the people that I call reactionaries are people who particularly value stability as opposed to control. I'll talk about that. And so you find, obviously, some very prominent right-wingers. So, you know, Pat Buchanan, I use as a classic example of, and the whole, what might be called a more European form of conservatism. Conservatism is a little more complicated in the United States because our traditions are liberal traditions, and so if you're going to conserve them, you know, there's a liberal element in it. But this sort of, these are charged words, but, you know, sort of nativism being close to the sorts of changes that come through trade and migration and cultural changes, whether those are lifestyle changes or cultural expression, you know, popular culture. Those are all, it's true that kind of conservative, what I would call reactionaries, have those qualities. But you'll also find that sort of idealization of a world that doesn't change on, for example, some of the more extreme elements of the green movement, which is, you know, traditionally classified as left wing. But even if you go back to a classic book like Small is Beautiful by E.F. Schumacher, his vision of the good society there is actually in a in a non-political sense, an extremely conservative vision. That is, it's a society that doesn't change, where people don't move around, where they have sort of limited trade or travel interactions with people from outside their areas, and you sometimes see that in the sort of bioregionalist movement, again, on the traditional left. But that is, I would say, also a reactionary stability is what's good viewpoint. The technocratic viewpoint, which you identify, I see why you identify that as kind of conventional liberalism, but it's really conventional everything in America and in most of the Western democracies, because early in the 20th century there was an ideal which came from observing, you know, sort of the organization of large enterprises, large corporations, were making efficiency gains, et cetera. And people thought, well, we could organize all of society that way and have kind of a regulatory rule of experts. We could be dispassionate and sort of not politicize things. I mean, this is where you get kind of the idea of the expert regulator as opposed to either the, you know, patronage view or a market view. You know, they're different alternatives, and this has been criticized, this technocratic vision has been criticized both from the point of view of kind of free market people on the right and from the point of view of people who have a more participatory political view, on the left, say, in the 1960s, that this kind of bureaucratic rule by experts has problems from a philosophical point of view. It also, I argue, has problems just from a pragmatic point of view. And that's the main reason it's sort of run out of intellectual steam, not that it's not present. I mean, it's sort of our default. If you see a problem in society, you think about how could we have, you know, regulate it. And this is not just if you see a problem. This is where it comes back to this question about the open-ended future. It's if there's something new that might present problems before you even find out if there are problems, which, you know, there might be problems, but the problems might not be the ones you expect. Before you actually see if there are problems, you say, oh my God, you know, the internet, we got to have regulation of internet content, because otherwise there'll be, you know, pornography or there'll be whatever. And now with biotech, we see a huge number of people anticipating, well, there could be this problem or there could be that problem or the other problem, and so let's kind of, you know, kill it in its crib.
You mentioned a second ago that you thought the 1960s participatory democratic ideals would be an example of dynamism. So do you think that there are examples on the left of anarcho-syndicalism and or traditional anarchism, other kinds of participatory and decentralist leftist philosophies,
right,
movements?
Well, I think the participatory democracy movement made very good critiques of some of the problems with the technocratic model. But I think the problem that it has is that it basically just substitutes a different form of technocracy, because the truth is that you get you're instead of getting ruled by quote unquote experts, you get ruled by, you know, self-appointed activists. It still becomes the sort of governance by people who are not necessarily ones, people find their lives affected by other people's decisions because those other people are, you know, more interested in politics, have more time, whatever it might be. And you've seen this a lot. I mean, a really good example of where that has come to be a conflict with sort of dynamic processes, even though it was a very good critique at the beginning, has to do with land use and development. So in the 60s, we had all these sort of technocratic schemes for remaking cities, and, you know, they've just come in and bulldoze neighborhoods and, you know, build concrete, whatever. And people said, well, this is wrong. You know, this is wrong in the sense that it's throwing people out of their homes. It's destroying the fabric of the cities. I mean, it had a lot of bad problems. But what's been substituted for this, and it's not always in the most idealistic way, but, you know, what's come about is a lot of public participation, quote unquote, in how land gets used. But the result of that is that you get things like, older people in a community, I don't want to stereotype, but that's often who has a lot of time, who are very conservative about the uses of whether, you know, they want to keep it exactly the same as it's always been. They're not necessarily open to new people. But first of all, they already live there, and the people who might move in are not there to, you know, they don't have a voice in the process. And so you find another kind of stasis sort of resulting from that.
I'm speaking with Virginia Prestrell. She's the editor-at-large of Reason magazine and author of The Future and Its Enemies. One of the critiques, I think, that might be made of that traditional libertarian view that the market is more dynamic than democratic processes is that in our society, in our market economy, large corporations are essentially command and control economies internally, and they also tend to dominate our democratic institutions in ways that are often, at best, ambivalent about dynamism and change, and often very conservative about dynamism and change, trying to protect their own power prerogatives. So you're not necessarily writing a defense of traditional Western market versus democracy. I understand.
No,
yeah.
Well, let me say, first of all, there's sort of two issues there. One has to do with the internal aspects of the corporation, which I'll talk about in a minute, and the other has to do with corporations and politics. And frankly, one of the reasons that I'm suspicious of, you know, of thinking that you can get out of these problems through, quote, more democracy, is that what that always turns into, for reasons that are perfectly understandable, is the people who have the greatest interest, you know, the most money on the line, whatever it is, you know, concentrated interest, and those are often corporations, but they could be unions, they could be farmers, I mean, you know, whatever it might be in the particular situation, those people will be disproportionately involved. And the sort of vast public who have a sort of general interest over time, but the individual small interest in a given issue isn't enough to make them spend their time on politics, those people get screwed. And it's not that markets are perfect, but it's that at least they have some checks on the problem of interest, the main one being competition. And in politics, there are forms of competition that are very important. So, for example, if you want to talk about localism, one of the advantages of localism is if you have a lot of different towns, say, and they adopt different land use rules or whatever it is, if people don't like the regime in one area, they can move to the other if they're small enough. You know, because it's much harder to leave the United States than, you know, to leave, I happen to be in the city limits of Dallas. If I, you know, move across the line into the city limits of Addison, which is indistinguishable as in many ways, but, you know, it could be in a different sort of political regime. That sort of competition, for population, for business, whatever it might be, is analogous to the kind of competition you find in the marketplace and in the sort of political marketplace. And I think that that's one reason that you don't want to centralize, you know, at the national level, lots and lots of stuff. The federalist system, whether it's the states competing as laboratories of democracy or whether it's individual towns competing, has a lot of advantages as far as that goes. In terms of the inside the corporation, that I think is less worrisome over the long term. And one of the great examples is a lot of the critiques that, and is less worrisome over the long term because of the competitive forces. I mean, it's much more worrisome that when corporations can use politics. I mean, we're seeing this, for example, in the whole copyright area where there's tremendous abuses taking place. Over the long term, if corporations are being too heavy-handed and too command and control within their own structure, there are corrections. So, for example, if you're too command and control, you don't get vital information from the guy, whether it's the worker on the line who really understands, you know, what's going wrong with the machinery or on the retail floor, who really understands what's going on with the, you know, with the customers and with the selling, or whether it's the salesman in the field who sees things. When it's very command and control, everything comes down from headquarters, vital information gets lost, and companies over the long run run into trouble from that. And, you know, there's many examples, and, you know, this has been a much documented change in corporate America over the past two or three decades has been a recognition of that that's something that management has to worry about, that they can't just decree, you know, that that in the same way you can't manage the entire economy just by decree, you can't completely manage a company, even though there's some advantages to the hierarchy.
That's actually a good segue, because one of the very interesting things I think that you bring out in your book is the your play theory of dynamism in Western civilization,
right,
as opposed to the repression theory,
right.
And the notion that a lot of people create and engage in work because they enjoy to do it. I have become because I come at this from a traditional kind of lefty utopian background. I saw that critique as fascinating, because one of the traditional justifications for the close linking of compensation and work is that people will only work if they get compensated. And conversely, if we were to establish a guaranteed minimum income, people argue that we would not have a dynamic society. Your theory of play as a principal motivator would seem to argue for the legitimacy of a policy of guaranteed minimum income.
Well, it's a complicated thing, because there are jobs, and there are all kinds of jobs that people don't really enjoy very much. The worst job I've ever seen people doing, in my opinion, is working in the chicken packing plant. No one would ever do that job except for money. I mean, it's noisy, it's bloody, it's unpleasant, it stinks. You don't get to talk to your fellow workers because it's too noisy to hear. I mean, it's a horrible, horrible job. And the only reason people would ever do it is because they get paid. And in fact, what's happened is, you know, it used to be poor Americans who did it, and they have found other opportunities, at least in the 90s, and then people, we got illegal immigrants doing it because it's a better opportunity for them for the money. So that's one kind of bad job. But the truth is, there are lots of even brain jobs that, I mean, you know, there's certain kinds of corporate law that surely no one does except for the money, you know. But the motivation, the point that I was trying to make in the play section is a point that I think gets lost a lot, definitely on the right and to some extent on the left as well, which is that when people are engaged, that much of the really creative, progressive work in society comes from people being very engaged with what they're doing. And, you know, there's this notion on the right, in particular, that you gotta, that work builds character because you do all these things that you hate. And therefore, if corporations are changing to, you know, encourage employees to be creative and, that's somehow a form of social decadence, as opposed to good business sense, which I would argue is good business sense, as well as making it more pleasant to work in. So I guess the question is, you know, what would people do if there were no financial incentives? I think there would be negative effects. But perhaps they wouldn't be as negative as we sometimes think, I guess would be the way to put it. I mean, there is this problem. I mean, there's another problem with that idea, which is, where is this money coming from, and how is it being, you know, if we want to go into our far futurism, right? If we go to the world where, you know, you have, like, I don't know, super nanotechnology, and you could just get whatever you need basically for free. I'm not sure we'll ever live in this world, but it's a conceivable world that we'll have, because of so much technological progress, we'll just have material abundance. It'll, you know, it won't really be an issue. so that de facto, you won't even have to worry about where would the minimum income come from. You know, it'll just be there. I think you wouldn't have a completely stagnant society. Some people would be stagnant. Some people would do the equivalent of watch television all day. But there would be people who really, really enjoyed creative work, whether it was art, whether it was invention, you know, whatever it might be, and it wouldn't be completely stagnant.
I'm speaking with Virginia Pestrell. She's editor-at-large of Reason Magazine, author of The Future and Its Enemies. She has a wonderful weblog at www.dynamist.com. I'm Jay Hughes, and this is Change Surfer Radio. Virginia, let's also address the biotech issues, because as we just took a turn there towards the futurism, and you address it in your book and beat up on some of my favorite bet noirs, Leon Cass and Jeremy Rifkin and those kinds of folks. This Bush administration has put in power Leon Cass over American bioethics, someone who is basically a 13th century bioethicist and is so out of step with most American bioethics. Not that you would agree with a lot of what comes out of American bioethics, but you definitely, and I definitely disagree with Leon Cass.
Right.
It kind of raises the whole question of whether the world is actually shaping up into a struggle between stasism and dynamism, because on the one hand, this administration is one of the most deregulatory and pro-business administrations, but on the other hand, it's culturally as stasist as you can
right.
get, and in particular when it comes to biotechnology.
Right. Well, first of all, I think, you know, I completely agree with you about Leon Cass. However, we do need there. It is important to say that he really has no power. I mean, you said he put them in power. He is really an advisor. He can't make, you know, it's not like the head of the FDA or something. I mean, he can't make any of his views law directly. And that's very important, because when the Bush administration essentially tried to make one of his views law, you know, had to get through two houses of Congress, and it didn't. And this was the ban on therapeutic cloning or cell cloning or whatever you want to call it, that is cloning for research purposes of cells as opposed to cloning for reproductive purposes. And that it passed the House overwhelmingly. There was a bill in the Senate, had bipartisan sponsorship, and this was a very egregious bill. I mean, it would have put scientists in jail for 10 years. If they cloned cells, which is a technique that could be used for, you know, it's a research technique right now, basic research technique, but, you know, theoretically could be used to treat Parkinson's disease or Alzheimer's, a number of different possibilities. And fortunately, we have gridlock. And in the Senate, neither side was able to get essentially the 60 votes that you have to pass anything in the Senate these days because of Senate rules, anything controversial. And so it didn't pass. I mean, it didn't get voted on it at all, one way or the other. And that, I think, was very good. Because I think, as you say, Leon Cass is out of sync with most bioethicists. He's also out of sync with kind of the just common sense views of Americans who want diseases cured.
He's pro-death. He says it's his mission.
I mean, I've called him. Yeah, I've talked about how there is this pro-death party or movement, which I used Leon Cass and also Daniel Callahan, who's an even more prominent bioethicist, more mainstream than Cass, more liberal, but it has similar views about limits being good, and how it's sort of ironic that their political strength is drawn from the, quote, pro-life party, which is the life begins at conception view. And, you know, if there weren't for that view, which is basically a religious view, they wouldn't have much success. But what's happened on biomedical issues is you've got this large group of social conservatives who believe, you know, a fertilized egg is a human being. They don't have any problem, for the most part, with the idea of biomedicine extending life, as long as it doesn't use embryos. But if it does use embryos, they want to make it illegal. Then you've got this group of more intellectual types, Leon Cass being probably the most prominent example, but not the only one, who have a problem with the goal. extending life, various kinds of, you know, sort of genetic medicine. And Jeremy Rifkin would be in that category, too, from the left. And they don't have any particular problem with using embryos, per se. They're not traditional, like, anti-abortion people. They're not even necessarily against abortion. But they've made this alliance with the anti-abortion people, who are more numerous, and in hopes of stopping these technologies. So far, they haven't succeeded, but it's a very dicey thing.
We were talking a second ago about the relative dynamism of state collective action versus the market. And in the case of biotechnology, well, in the case of future technology in general, don't you think there's a case to be made for a kind of pro-dynamist federal policy of underwriting basic research? We had the, under Clinton, we had the $500 million nanotechnology initiatives. We've had DARPA, which gave birth to the NET. We've had Medicare, which gave birth to a huge expansion of medical care in this country. Isn't there some set of federal policies, collective policies, which underwrite and support dynamism?
Right. Well, it's a tricky question, and I was at a very interesting conference, I don't know, maybe 9 months ago, of people talking about this question, not so much things like Medicare, but the general issue of government funding of scientific research, basic research, not applied research so much. And I don't think there wasn't a single consensus on whether it's good or bad for government to fund it. I mean, some people were on one side, and probably the majority of people thought it was generally good, and there was a minority that was ambivalent or thought it was, there were a few people who actually thought it was bad. But there was one point that we all agreed on, and I think it's really the critical point, which is that you need multiple sources of funding, multiple competitive sources of funding. They can be different agencies of the government. They can be different levels of government, state, federal. They can be private and public. And, in fact, one of the great things in the United States is that we have all of these. We have different agencies of government. We have state and federal. We have private and public. And the result of that is that you get more different approaches competing with each other.
You have California, which has a really different policy now towards cloning.
Yes, that's a very interesting example. That in California, they've taken sort of the opposite tack on this research cloning, and they're saying, you know, yeah, come here and do it, and we'll see how that plays out. But I think even if a federal ban were to be passed, you could probably structure programs within California where they were just within the state, and under the Commerce Clause of the Constitution, you know, if it's in the same state, and there have been some interesting rulings by this Supreme Court in recent years saying, you know, there is no federal interest. You can't interfere, and I think particularly in areas fundamental in sort of implicated in First Amendment freedoms and stuff like this, they would have a good chance of that.
Well, Virginia, your work is fascinating, and keep up the goodness of it. But the web log at www.dynamist.com will keep you up to date with Virginia Pastrell's work. And her book that we've been discussing was The Future and Its Enemies, The Growing Conflict Over Creativity, Enterprise, and Progress. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS FM at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about this show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. You can also check out past and future shows, archived in streaming MP3, and myriad relevant links at the website www.changesurfer.com.